And, of course, diesel Mercedes often can last for hundreds of thousands of miles before they need an overhaul. It also has classic styling. How much time and energy did Dr. North expend in purchasing his Mercedes? Let's examine his decision-making process. First, he decided that he needed to replace his old car. After all, it was 20 years old. He knew that many European luxury automobiles depreciate rapidly during the first 3 years following their initial purchase. So he figured that he might be able to save a considerable amount if he purchased a 3-year-old Mercedes-Benz. He confirmed this speculation by determining the original retail price of the model he was interested in purchasing. A quick trip to a local dealer was all that was required to gain this knowledge. Dr. North then decided that his best choice would be a 3-year-old model. He telephoned a few dealers and advised them of his interest. He also examined several advertisements in the classified section of the paper. Finally, he decided on a low-mileage model offered by a local dealer. As he explained, "Automobiles? I've always placed a premium on quality, but I never lease, never finance. I drive a Mercedes-Benz. Since I started my practice, I've only had 2 cars. The first, a Mercedes, I purchased new just after I opened my practice. Kept it 20 years. Then I bought my second car, a 3-year-old Mercedes. I went to a dealer. He wanted to sell me a new one, but it was $20,000 more than the used one on the lot. Then I just asked myself a simple question. Is the pride of new car ownership, and that's all it is, pride, worth $20,000? The cars are the same. The answer is no. The pride of new car ownership is not worth $20,000. The North method took only a few hours. Contrast this with Dr. South's automobile purchasing crusade, a process that took him at least 60 hours. And, of course, Dr. North likes to keep his cars for a long time. So his allocation of purchasing time is spread over several years. On average, he devotes less than an hour a year to purchasing motor vehicles. But Dr. South likes to buy a new car every year. Thus, his 60-hour project is typically allocated to only 1 year. Fears and worries. What do you spend time worrying about? Are your concerns congruent with wealth accumulation? Or do you spend time thinking about issues that are impediments to becoming affluent? How do PAWs and UAWs differ in regard to their fears and concerns? In simple terms, UAWs worry more than PAWs. PAWs and UAWs also worry about different issues. Overall, PAWs have significantly fewer concerns and fears than their counterparts. What if you spend much of your time thinking about a lot of issues that concern you? You will spend less time taking action to solve these problems. And what if your fears provide a foundation for increased spending? You may be a member of the UAW group. Fears and concerns can be both a cause for becoming a UAW as well as a result. Will a person who constantly worries about earning more money to enhance his lifestyle become wealthy? Probably not. Dr. South is not wealthy, in part because he concerns himself with such issues. Dr. North is wealthy today because he placed much less priority on standard of living issues than did Dr. South. Dr. South told us that 19 issues were of high or moderate concern to him. Dr. North was concerned with only about 7 issues. Thus, it's only logical to conclude that the Dr. Norths of this country have more time and energy to devote to wealth-enhancing activities. Let's examine how these doctors' fears and worries, or lack of them, have affected their lives. The children of UAWs and PAWs. The Souths have 4 children. 2 are adults. Dr. South has serious, well-founded concerns about their future. UAWs tend to produce children who eventually become UAWs themselves. What is expected of children who are exposed to a household environment predicated upon very high consumption, few, if any, economic constraints, little planning or budgeting, no discipline, and pandering to every product-related desire? Like their UAW parents, as adults, these children are often addicted to an undisciplined, high-consumption lifestyle. Further, these children typically will never earn the incomes necessary to support the lifestyle to which they have grown accustomed. Certainly, Dr. South's parents' indulgent lifestyle contributed to his becoming a UAW, and he learned so well. His lifestyle is even more consumption-oriented than that of his mother and father. His upper-middle-class lifestyle was never interrupted, even when he was in graduate school and medical school. His parents paid for his home and all other expenses. They provided him with substantial gifts of cash each year. In essence, he never really had to change his consumption habits or standard of living after leaving home. Fortunately for him, he has the income to support his addiction to consumption. But what about his children? They have lived in a high-consumption environment that would be extremely difficult to replicate on their own. The curtain is coming down on the third generation. Dr. South indicated in our interviews with us that he believed his children would never generate even a fraction of the income he currently earns. In comparison, Dr. North's adult children are demonstrating more independence and discipline, in part because they've been exposed to a much more frugal, well-planned, and disciplined lifestyle. As we noted, the Norths consume at a level that is more congruent with a household earning less than one-third of their income. This living below their means is precisely why PAWs throughout the income spectrum tend to produce children who are economically disciplined and self-sufficient adults. PAWs tend to produce children who become PAWs. Dr. South, as indicated, has accumulated considerably less wealth than Dr. North. He is significantly less able than Dr. North to support the economic outpatient care of his adult children. But ironically, it is Dr. South who is burdened by having economically dependent adult children. We questioned both Dr. South and Dr. North about their fears and worries concerning their children. As you may have already predicted, Dr. South is much more concerned about this issue. He specifically expressed fears of 1. Having adult children who think his wealth is their income. 2. Having to support his adult children financially. Imagine how disconcerting it is for someone like Dr. South to face the prospect of supporting his extended family. Later, we will explore the implications of economic outpatient care in great detail. However, there is an important point to note at this time. Having adult children who are UAWs greatly reduces the probability that their parents will ever become wealthy. Dr. South wonders where his children got the idea that their parents would provide them with substantial economic outpatient care. He worries that he will not have the resources to provide his children with all the subsidies his parents gave him. There is yet another fear Dr. South must face. He is becoming more and more worried that his children will not get along with each other. Much of this concern is rooted in their need for economic support from their parents. Dr. North does not worry about such issues. We asked both doctors about these types of concerns. Dr. South worried that his family and children will fight over his estate, and that he will be accused of financially favoring one adult child over another. Are Dr. South's fears justified? Ask yourself this question. What is the greatest fear of the 30-year-old sons and daughters of the Dr. Souths of America? That the economic outpatient care they receive from their parents will stop. Many 30-something UAWs cannot maintain anywhere near the lifestyle they had while living with dad and mom. In fact, many are unable to purchase even a modest home without financial subsidies from their parents. It is not unusual for these rich kids to receive substantial cash and other financial gifts until they are in their late 40s or even early 50s. Often, these adult UAWs compete with each other for their parents' wealth. What would you do if your economic subsidy was being threatened by the presence of your equally dependent brothers and sisters? Dr. South is not only worried about his problems, he is also worried about his children's problems. Consider for a moment the legacy he is leaving them. What are the ramifications of being an economically dependent adult? How much insecurity and fear will they have to deal with in the future? How will they be able to have harmonious, loving relationships with each other? These are among the issues Dr. South spends more and more time contemplating. Dr. North is much less concerned with such problems. His adult children are accustomed to living in a much more frugal and disciplined environment. They are less likely to have a perceived need for major doses of economic outpatient care. Taxes, government, and government. Many high-income earners in America, both PAWs and UAWs, are greatly concerned about the actions of the federal government. These actions are external forces, those over which an individual has no control. Dr. South indicated that he feared four external forces that are government-related. Interestingly, these issues are not of major concern to Dr. North. Let's look at these four concerns. 1. Paying increasingly high federal income taxes. Both physicians think that the federal government is likely to require high-income producers to pay more in taxes. But tax increases are more the concern of Dr. South than of Dr. North. Why is Dr. South concerned about this issue? Because he needs to maximize his realized income to support his hyper-consumption lifestyle. If the government requires Dr. South to pay a higher share of his income, his lifestyle will be threatened. What about Dr. North? He told us that he had a low level of concern over the prospects of the federal government increasing the share of his realized income that he must pay in taxes. Last year, Dr. North paid approximately $277,000 in income taxes. This may seem like a big bite, but look at it through the eyes of Dr. North. He looks at income tax more as a portion of his total wealth than a portion of his realized income. What if the government doubled the tax rate on high incomes? This is very unlikely, but just as an example, Dr. North would then have to pay the equivalent of 8% of his wealth each year. By comparison, Dr. South would be at a wealth rate of 150%. Is it any wonder Dr. North is much less concerned about paying increasingly higher federal income taxes than Dr. South is? 2. Increased government spending and the federal deficit. Dr. South is very concerned about this issue. He believes that increased spending on the part of the government will translate into higher taxes on his income. Dr. North is not overly concerned for the reasons stated above. 3. A high rate of inflation. Dr. South is also concerned that such government action as increased spending and an increase in the deficit will precipitate a significant increase in the inflation rate. Dr. South has a moderate level of concern about this issue because he, like many UAWs, keeps trading up to more and more expensive homes, cars, clothes, and so on. On the other hand, Dr. North feels that inflation will significantly increase the value of at least part of his investment portfolio. 4. Increased government regulation of business and industry. Most physicians feel that this type of government action is targeted at them. They interpret increases in government regulation as preceding the advent of socialized medicine. Both physicians feel that this would have a dampening effect on the fees they generate for their professional services. Dr. South indicated that this issue is of significant concern to him, while Dr. North viewed such action as only a minor concern. Why do these two respondents perceive things so differently? The actions of the government are often a threat to high-income earners who use most of their incomes to support their lifestyles. This is especially true when there is political gain for those in power in targeting the wealthy. Actually, the people the politicians are targeting are high-income earners. Most politicians don't understand the difference between having a high income and having high levels of wealth. They have a more difficult time targeting people with high levels of net worth. Most millionaires who are PAWs are self-employed. Being self-employed gives one much more control over one's economic future than does working for others. Conversely, employees today, even high-income producing executives, have less control over their livelihoods than ever before. Downsizing, for example, is taking its toll, even among the most productive employees. More often than not, even high-income producing employees are not likely to be millionaires. UAWs who are employees, not self-employed, are particularly vulnerable to external forces that threaten their ability to earn a living. We found that only 19% of PAWs versus 36% of high-income producing non-millionaires, UAWs, were concerned about having their jobs eliminated. But in spite of the handwriting that is often on the wall, even most high-income earning employees are consumption-oriented. Financial goals, words versus deeds. Many high-income producing PAWs and UAWs share similarly stated goals concerning wealth accumulation. For example, more than three-fourths of both groups indicated they had the following goals: to become wealthy by the time they retire, to increase their wealth, to become wealthy through capital appreciation, to build their capital while conserving the value of their assets. But having a set of stated goals does not necessarily mean that one is committed to achieving them. Most of us want to be wealthy, but most of us do not spend the time, energy, and money required to enhance our chances of realizing this goal. Time allocation. Most PAWs agree with the following statements, while most UAWs disagree. I spend a lot of time planning my financial future. Usually I have sufficient time to handle my investments properly. When it comes to the allocation of my time, I place the management of my own assets before my other activities. Conversely, UAWs tend to agree with the following statements. I can't devote enough time to my investment decisions. I'm just too busy to spend much time with my own financial affairs. PAWs and UAWs also differ in the amount of time they actually allocate to planning their investments. Planning is typically found to be a strong habit among people who have a demonstrated propensity to accumulate wealth. Planning and wealth accumulation are significant correlates even among investors with modest incomes. In our survey of 854 middle-income respondents, a strong positive correlation was found between investment planning and wealth accumulation. One of the more interesting findings in our studies of the affluent relates to why many people spend so little time planning their investments. Many people who do little or no investment planning often feel the way these respondents did. It's hopeless. I never have the time needed to make it pay off. We never have made so much, but the more we earn, the less we seem to accumulate. Our careers take up all our time. I don't have 20 hours a week to fool with investing my money. But PAWs do not spend anywhere near 20 hours a week in this way. On average, even prodigious accumulators of wealth do not need to devote a large proportion of their time to planning their investment strategies. We found that these middle-income PAWs spend an average of only 8.4 hours per month planning their investments. This translates to about 100.8 hours per year. Given that there are 8,760 hours in a year, PAWs allocate approximately 1.2% of their time planning their investments. UAWs, on average, spend 4.6 hours per month planning their investments, or about 55.2 hours per year. In other words, PAWs spend an average of 83% more hours planning per month than do UAWs. UAWs allocate only 1 in 160 hours of their total available time to planning their investments. PAWs allocate 1 in 87 hours. Will UAWs automatically become PAWs simply by doubling the number of hours they devote to planning their investments? Not likely. Planning is only one of many key ingredients in building wealth. Most PAWs have a regimented planning schedule. Each week, each month, each year, they plan their investments. They also start planning at a much earlier age than do UAWs. UAWs, on the other hand, are much like some overweight people who occasionally starve themselves to reach their ideal weight. But more often than not, they regain all the weight they lost and more. UAWs may start the new year with a plan that outlines a variety of investment goals. These goals may be the product of a couple of days of aggressive planning that specifies the number of dollars allocated to investments. Also included in the plan may be a significant cold turkey reduction in the consumption of goods and services. More often than not, this shock planning and corresponding radical change in lifestyle are so severe that they do not work. The typical UAW in this case quickly becomes disenchanted with his new model for wealth building. Soon, he falls off the wagon, once again breaking his promise of planning, investing more, and consuming less. Many UAWs think that a professionally prepared plan will make them PAWs overnight. But even the best financial plans are ineffective if you don't follow them. All too often, UAWs think that others can lose weight for them. The UAWs in such cases would greatly benefit from understanding how PAWs operate. PAWs do a little planning each and every month. Again, only about 8 hours a month. UAWs might do more planning if they knew that it would not require them to quit their day jobs. PAWs build wealth slowly. They do not live a Spartan existence, but they do have a regimen when it comes to balancing working, planning, investing, and consuming. Your time is your own. The work factor is an important part of understanding the differences between PAWs and UAWs. Note, in our study of middle-income respondents, the percentage, 59.1 versus 24.7, of PAWs versus UAWs who are self-employed. In this study, self-employment correlated significantly with planning investments. Overall, the self-employed spend more time planning their investment strategies than those who work for others. The self-employed, even those with middle incomes, typically integrate investment planning into their work lives. Most employees, in sharp contrast, have a set of job-related tasks that are independent of planning their investment strategies. Why is this so? Those who succeed among the ranks of the self-employed never take their economic position for granted. Most middle-aged people who are self-employed have seen good as well as bad economic times. They tend to offset the inevitable changes in their revenue by planning and investing. They must build and manage their pension plans by themselves. They have to rely on themselves for their current and future financial situations. More often than not, only the well-disciplined self-employed survive economically over the long run. But, you may ask, don't these people work long and hard? Yes. Most successful people who are self-employed work 10 to 14 hours per day. In fact, this is why many employees shy away from even considering going out on their own. They want something less demanding. They want to be employees. But most workers, even those with middle-level incomes, also work long and hard. As for employees who earn annual incomes in the upper five or lower six digits, much of their time and energy is allocated to their jobs. They usually don't have the benefit of writing their own job descriptions. And their occupational tasks typically don't include setting aside a few hours per week to plan their investments. In contrast, the self-employed, especially in the high-income category, have a different set of occupational goals. One of them is to become financially independent. Conversely, employees are too often fully dependent on their employers. Thus, they tend to be less self-reliant when it comes to planning their investments in a way that will facilitate accumulating wealth. There is another issue to consider in the planning equation. UAWs spend less time planning their investments than do PAWs, in part because of the nature of their investments. UAWs consider cash, near cash, and equivalents, such as saving accounts, money market funds, and short-term treasury bills, to be investments. UAWs are nearly twice as likely as PAWs to hold at least 20% of their total wealth in cash or near cash. Most of these cash categories are federally insured. Most are easily accessed when consumption needs arise. And of course, it takes less time to plan cash-related investments than it does to allocate wealth the way PAWs tend to do. PAWs are more likely to invest in categories that usually appreciate in value but do not produce realized income. They tend to have a greater percentage of their wealth invested in privately held or closely held businesses, commercial real estate, publicly traded equities, and their pension plans, annuities, and other tax-deferred categories. These types of investments require planning. They are also the foundation for wealth. UAWs hold a larger percentage of their wealth in motor vehicles and other assets that tend to depreciate. Active or inactive trader. Nearly all, 95% of the millionaires we surveyed own stocks. Most have 20% or more of their wealth in publicly traded stocks. Yet you would be wrong to assume that these millionaires actively trade their stocks. Most don't follow the ups and downs of the market day by day. Most don't call their stockbrokers each morning to ask how the London market did. Most don't trade stocks in response to daily headlines in the financial media. Do you define active investors as people who, on average, keep an investment for days? Of the millionaires we interviewed, fewer than 1% of those who own stock are in this league. How about weeks? Another 1%. Let's move up to those who, on average, hold on for months but less than a year. Fewer than 7% are monthly investors. Overall, only about 9% of the millionaires we have interviewed hold their investments for less than 1 year. In other words, fewer than 1 in 10 millionaires are active investors. 1 in 5 hold on average for a year or two. 1 in 4 hold for between 2 and 4 years. About 13% are in the 4 to 6 year category. More than 3 in 10 hold their investments for more than 6 years. In fact, 42% of the millionaires we interviewed for our latest survey had made no trades whatsoever in their stock portfolios in the year prior to the interview. The so-called active investor is one of the more difficult types of millionaires to find for interview purposes. He may be an ideal target market for stockbrokers. He certainly spends considerable amounts for brokerage fees related to his trading, but he represents a very small minority of the millionaire population. In fact, we have encountered more non-millionaire active traders than millionaires who actively trade. How can this be possible? Because it is very expensive to buy and sell one's equity holdings each day or week or month. Often, active investors spend more time trading than studying and planning their investments. Conversely, millionaires spend more time studying far fewer offerings. Thus, they can focus their time and energy. The resources needed to master their understanding of a much smaller variety of offerings in the market. We have always been interested in studying the wealth accumulation habits of stockbrokers. Compared with the members of other industries, stockbrokers earn high incomes. They have access to large amounts of research data. Also, they pay less than other people when they trade securities because they earn their own commissions. Are all these high-income-producing investment advisors wealthy? Not by a long shot. We have asked many stockbrokers about this issue. Perhaps one individual stockbroker stated it best when he told us, "I'd be rich if I would just keep my stocks, but I can't help but make trades in my own portfolio. I'm looking at the screen every day." Keep in mind that this broker's net annual income is in excess of $200,000, but he's a very active investor. He rarely allows the investment seeds he sows to grow. Any short-term realized gains he enjoys are taxed immediately. He is not the type of broker a millionaire prefers to patronize. Then what type do they prefer? Far less active investors. They prefer to deal with those who believe in buying based on considerable studying and then holding. Let's return to our case studies, Doctors North and South, to see financial planning in action. Comparing times. Dr. North allocates about 10 hours in a typical month, or 120 hours a year, to studying and planning his future investment decisions. In contrast, Dr. South allocates 3 hours a month, or fewer than 40 hours a year. Who spends more time managing his current investments? Again, the answer is predictable. Dr. North, on average, allocates about 20 hours a month, or 240 hours in a typical year, for this purpose, while his counterpart reported spending only 1 hour per month managing his current investments. Certainly, this is a contributing factor to Dr. South's low net worth. Dr. North is a focused investor. He has two favorite investment categories, agricultural land and stocks from the medical industry. First, a fellow I attended medical school with, he saved the life of a patient who believed in investing in grade A agriculture and orchards. My colleague invested and told me about it. He told me that these people were very honest. I met them and agreed. I've been investing ever since, still investing regularly today. I've made most in the stock market from the medical industry, drug companies and medical instrument companies. I know this area. I do research on the medical drug field. That's what Warren Buffett does. Invest in companies that he knows and understands. But you must have seed money or savings to invest in areas you have knowledge. I have over $2 million in my profit-sharing plan. Dr. South is responsible for making the major investment decisions in his family. It was his decision to have accounts at 4 different full-service brokerage firms. But surprisingly, Dr. South has less than $200,000 in securities. Then why does he have 4 different financial advisors? Because he believes, incorrectly, that he does not need to spend time making his own investment decisions. He admitted to us that he would be really affluent if he did not take advice from these so-called experts. But even bad advice does not come cheap. We estimated that Dr. South spent over $35,000 in a single year for advice and trades related to his poorly performing $200,000 portfolio. What about Dr. North? During the same period, he spent $0 for transaction fees and $0 for financial advice. He is his own financial advisor. He rarely sells stocks. Also, there are no transaction fees for his direct investing in farmland and its products. Dr. South, in traditional UAW fashion, has been burned by financial advisors. Too often, people in his position respond to cold calls from brokers who are touting the stock of the week. Too often, Dr. South is late entering the upmarket and exits it too early. In sharp contrast, most of the PAWs we have interviewed make their own investment decisions. They take the time and energy to study investment opportunities. They consult with financial advisors. But ultimately, their investment decisions are their own. Dr. South has a history of trading rapidly among his broker's flavors of the month. He spends many dollars for these trades. If these flavors appreciate in value, they precipitate capital gains taxes. On the other hand, when stocks in a pension plan are traded, they are not subject to capital gains taxes. Unfortunately, Dr. South is not a big fan of pension plans. We estimated that he had less than $40,000 in his plan at the time of our interview with him. Who are your suppliers? How did you hire your household's financial advisor? Did you list the position in the Help Wanted section of your local newspaper? Did you evaluate the stacks of resumes your advertisement generated? Or did you ask your accountant, attorney, or minister to help you find a quality advisor? Many people tell us that such methods are just too much work. This is unfortunate. The more intellect, time, and energy you spend in hiring a financial advisor, the more likely you will be to find a suitable one. Perhaps you're not convinced about the need to exert yourself in this task. Look at it another way. How much time and effort did it take you to find your most recent employment position? What are the chances that you could call General Motors, IBM, or Microsoft and obtain a job today by phone? What theme would you use? Hi, I'm a red-hot potential employee. I can greatly enhance the productivity of any department in which I'm placed. I'm smart, efficient, positive, personable, well-groomed, resourceful, and have empathy for the needs of others. When do you want me to start? Your chances of being hired by placing a telephone call, especially a cold call, are near zero. Then why do so many people hire their financial advisor after he or she made a cold call to them? Because they are not experienced in hiring employees. Why aren't you as wealthy as you should be? It may be because of the way you operate your household. Would a business, especially a very productive one, ever hire a key employee without doing a serious background check and an in-depth interview? No. Yet most people, even those with high incomes, hire financial advisors after obtaining little or no background information about these employment candidates. Some high-income people have responded to our views on this topic by stating, "But I'm not hiring an employee. I'm just doing some investing with the fellow who called on me." Our response to such statements is simple. Operate your household like a productive business. The best businesses hire the best people. They also patronize the best suppliers. Utilizing the best human resources and top suppliers are two major reasons the most productive organizations succeed while others fail. You should view all financial advisors who solicit you as a client merely as applicants. View them as prospective employees or suppliers for your household. Then ask yourself some simple questions. What criteria would a productive personnel manager use in evaluating each of these applicants? Would a skilled purchasing agent and/or a chief financial officer of an organization buy investment information and products from this potential supplier? What criteria, what key pieces of background information would be used to evaluate potential suppliers? Before a well-run business would ever hire a financial advisor or a supplier of investment intellect, it would insist on many vital pieces of hard copy, including the following: several references, an official college transcript, a credit check, a series of personal interviews, completion of a detailed employment application, documents attesting to the ability of the applicant to perform the duties and tasks required. Your ability to hire high-grade financial advisors is directly related to your propensity to accumulate wealth. This, in turn, relates to one of the fundamental reasons business owners outpace all other occupational categories in accumulating wealth. Most high-income business owners have more experience in evaluating potential suppliers, employee applicants, and human resources in general than do individuals in other occupational groups. Being in business requires the constant evaluation of such resources. The Martin Method. Several years ago, we had the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Martin, a very astute investor and a self-made millionaire. Mr. Martin participated in a focus group interview we conducted with 8 multimillionaires. To be included in the group, respondents had to have a net worth of $5 million or more. Building a net worth of $5 million or more in one generation is quite an accomplishment. But Mr. Martin is rare even within this category, since he never had an earned annual income from employment of more than $75,000. How did Mr. Martin become so wealthy? He is one of the best investors we have ever interviewed. Mr. Martin made his fortune via the stock market. We found him to be extremely bright and well-informed about various investments. He is also an excellent judge of investment advisors. As you may expect, Mr. Martin subscribes to a wide variety of investment-related publications. Several of these sell their mailing lists to brokers. Thousands of financial advisors have access to Mr. Martin's address and telephone number. Mr. Martin estimates that each week, at least 3 or 4 brokers attempt to solicit his investment dollars via cold calls. How does Mr. Martin deal with these callers? He instructs his secretary to follow the Martin Method, which is used to debrief all callers. What is the Martin Method? Here is what he told us during the interview. I am a businessman who goes out and tests people. Brokers call me a lot. They say I have a great deal of experience in Wall Street's best offerings. I have a fantastic track record of making money for my clients. I always say, do you have some good investment ideas for me? Really good. He says, absolutely, especially if you're willing to make trades in your portfolio. I only handle accounts with a minimum of $200,000. Then I tell him, so you're really good. Well, I'll tell you what. Send me a copy of your personal income tax returns from the last few years and a list of what you have had in your own portfolio for the past 3 years. If you made more money than I did from investments, I'll invest with you. Here's my address. When they say we can't show that to you, I tell them you're likely to be full of baloney. This is my strategy for checking people out. It works. I check them all out this way. I mean it very honestly. Perhaps you're asking yourself how Mr. Martin finds time to evaluate all those stacks of credentials he receives from cold callers. During the many years Mr. Martin has been an active investor, he has received countless telephone solicitations. How many of these solicitors applied for the job as financial advisor to the Martin household by submitting their credentials? Zero. Not one of the dozens of cold callers submitted his income and wealth appreciation data to Mr. Martin. According to Mr. Martin, if these guys were really good, they would not spend all their time calling me. Well, fair enough, Mr. Martin, but not everyone in America has your investment intellect, income, and net worth. Many people would be better off financially if they used the services of a financial advisor, even one who cold called them, for the simple reason that most financial advisors are significantly more knowledgeable about investing than the average high-income UAW.
How one comes into contact with one's financial advisor is a correlate of wealth appreciation. How did Mr. Martin come into contact with his? Like the majority of PAWs, he used interpersonal communication. Early in his career, he asked his accountant for a referral to a quality financial advisor. The accountant provided the names of several such advisors. Mr. Martin also asked for referrals from those of the accountant's clients, whose investments always seemed to do well. Mr. Martin has patronized several financial advisors since first being introduced via his accountant. He also relies on others for investment advice, including his attorney and CPA. Mr. Martin always felt his financial advisors were credible sources of investment wisdom because all were endorsed by his CPA and/or his CPA's most successful investors. Also, Mr. Martin reasoned quite correctly that these financial advisors would treat him as a special client. And, indeed, they went out of their way to provide him with good advice and timely forecasts. Why? To do otherwise would jeopardize their relationships with their referral network. What would Mr. Martin do if his advisors provided him with poor service and low-quality advice? He would complain to the CPA who endorsed these people. The CPA would not enjoy losing Mr. Martin as a client and would likely cast these advisors out of his referral network. No financial advisor would enjoy being fired in this way. Even better-grade advisors seem to turn up their level of service for members of important referral networks. What is to be learned from this case scenario? Choose a financial advisor who is endorsed by an enlightened accountant and/or his clients with investment portfolios that in the long run outpace the market. If you don't have an accountant, hire one. Another correlate of wealth accumulation is employment of a CPA, not just to do taxes, but also to provide various kinds of investment advice. To find a high-quality accountant, ask friends or associates who fit the PAW profile. You may wish to call the accounting department at your state's university. Speak with several accounting faculty. Ask them for the names of their former students who have established track records in helping clients make enlightened financial decisions. Another method is to call the local offices of national accounting firms, which are often very selective in their hiring. Even large firms have many smaller accounting and financial planning clients. We selected our CPAs based on two criteria. First, the CPAs were recommended by professors of accounting. Second, the CPAs were initially hired out of college by major accounting firms and later started their own successful accounting firms. We find that many of the very best CPAs and financial planners follow this career path. Some CPAs are better than others at helping clients accumulate wealth. Interview several. Choose the one who has the highest concentration of PAWs as clients. You may have to explain the concept to them. You aren't what you drive. They believe that financial independence is more important than displaying high social status. Mr. W.W. Allen is a self-made multimillionaire. He and his wife have lived in the same three-bedroom house in the same middle-class neighborhood for nearly 40 years. Mr. Allen owns and manages two manufacturing businesses in the Midwest. During his entire married life, he has owned only full-sized General Motors sedans. He will tell you that he never burdened himself with status vehicles or products of any kind. Mr. Allen's businesses, as well as his household, are highly efficient operations. The productivity of his businesses, coupled with his household's moderate consumption habits, produced many surplus dollars. These, in turn, were reinvested in his businesses, commercial real estate, and the common stocks of a variety of high-quality American corporations. Mr. Allen is what we call a super PAW. His net worth exceeds the expected value for people in his income/age category by more than tenfold. During the course of his career, Mr. Allen has helped many other entrepreneurs. He has acted as a mentor to dozens of business owners and has saved many businesses from going under by giving financial assistance to struggling entrepreneurs. But he never extended credit to people who exhibited the big hat, no cattle philosophy. In his mind, such people would never be able to repay their debts. These types, according to Mr. Allen, spend, spend, spend in anticipation of having money before they even earn it. Mr. Allen, as well as those people whom he has backed financially, have never felt that their purpose in life was to look wealthy. According to Mr. Allen, that's why I'm financially independent. If your goal is to become financially secure, you'll likely attain it. But if your motive is to make money to spend money on the good life, you're never going to make it. Many people who never achieve financial independence have a much different set of beliefs. When we ask them about their motives, they speak in terms of work and career. But ask them why they work so hard, why they selected the careers they did, and their answers are much different from Mr. Allen's. They are UAWs. And UAWs, especially high-income producers, work to spend, not to achieve or become financially independent. UAWs view life as a series of trade-ups from one level of luxury to the next. So who enjoys working? Who really gets satisfaction from their careers, PAWs or UAWs? In most of the cases we have examined, PAWs love working, while a large portion of UAWs work because they need to support their conspicuous consumption habit. Such people and their motives offend Mr. Allen. He stated numerous times, "Money should never change one's values. Making money is only a report card. It's a way to tell you how you're doing." No Rolls Royce, please. Mr. Allen is extremely perceptive in his understanding of under-accumulators of wealth. In essence, he feels that products change people. If you acquire one status product, you will likely have to purchase others to fill up the socially conspicuous puzzle. Before long, your entire lifestyle will have changed. Mr. Allen clearly understands the complementary nature of status products and a high consumption lifestyle. He will have none of these artifacts. They are a threat, as he sees it, to his rather simple yet highly efficient lifestyle. Building wealth is not something that will change your lifestyle. Even at this stage of life, I don't want to change the way I live. Mr. Allen's values and priorities were recently tested. Several of those people whom Mr. Allen helped stay in business decided to purchase a special birthday gift for him. What a nice gesture, they thought. But status gifts, whether from friends or rich parents, are not always congruent with the recipient's values and lifestyle. And often such gifts place tremendous pressure on the recipients to spend more and more of their income to fill in the picture. Some wealthy parents buy their adult children homes in affluent neighborhoods. Great idea? Perhaps they should realize that affluent neighborhoods are high consumption neighborhoods. From property taxes to the pressure to decorate, from the perceived need to send their children to expensive private schools, to the $40,000 four-wheel drive luxury Suburban, the children are now on the earn-to-spend treadmill. Thanks, Mom and Dad. As Mr. Allen, the super PAW, told us, something interesting recently happened. I discovered I was to be given a surprise present from several close business associates, a Rolls Royce for a present. It was ordered for me, special color, special interior. They ordered it about 4 months before I found out about it. Still had about 5 months before delivery. How do you go and tell somebody who wants to give you a Rolls Royce that you don't want it? Why did Mr. Allen refuse to accept such a marvelous gift? There's nothing the Rolls Royce represents that's important in my life, nor would I want to have to change my life to go along with owning the Rolls. I can't throw fish in the back seat of the Rolls like I do right now when I go fishing. I'm going to have to get you all to the lake. I'm out fishing here every weekend. We have some of the best freshwater fishing in the country, right out here where I keep my fishing boat. Mr. Allen's type of fishing includes throwing bloody fish in the back seat of his 4-year-old, full-sized, American-made, non-luxury vehicle. But such behavior is incongruent with driving a Rolls-Royce down to the lake. It would be out of place. Mr. Allen would not feel comfortable with such a vehicle. Thus, he contended, he had to change his behavior by ceasing to fish or refuse the gift. Let's consider Mr. Allen's dilemma further. His office is located in his manufacturing plant, which is in an old industrial area. An automobile like the one being offered might well be out of place in such an environment. And of course, Mr. Allen does not want to operate 2 vehicles. That would be inefficient. Mr. Allen also feels that a luxury car would alienate many of his workers. They might get the feeling that their boss was exploiting them. How else could he afford such an expensive vehicle? There are other considerations as well. With a Rolls, I can't go to some of the crummy restaurants I enjoy going to. Can't drive up in a Rolls Royce. So, no, thank you. And so I had to call and say, I really got to tell you something. That I don't want it. It's totally unimportant. There are some things that are more fun to do, more interesting to do, than owning a Rolls. Mr. Allen recognizes that many status artifacts can be a burden, if not an impediment, to becoming financially independent. Life has its own burdens. Why add excess baggage? Buying cars, millionaire style. How do millionaires go about acquiring motor vehicles? About 81% purchase their vehicles. The balance, lease. Only 23.5% of millionaires own new cars. Most have not purchased a car in the last 2 years. In fact, 25.2% have not purchased a motor vehicle in 4 years or more. How much do millionaires pay for these vehicles? The typical millionaire, those in the 50th percentile, paid $24,800 for his most recent acquisition. 30% spent $19,500 or less. The average American buyer of a new motor vehicle paid more than $21,000 for his most recent acquisition. This is not much less than the $24,800 paid by millionaires. Moreover, not all of these millionaires purchased new vehicles. How many indicated that their most recent vehicle was used? Nearly 37%. In addition, many millionaires indicated that they traded down recently. That is, purchased lower-priced vehicles than they had before. What is the most that these millionaires ever paid for their motor vehicles? 50% of the millionaires we surveyed never spent more than $29,000 in their entire lives for a motor vehicle. About 1 in 5, or 20%, never spent more than $19,950. 80% paid $41,300 or less to acquire their most expensive motor vehicle. What if we separate out from our sample those millionaires who told us they had inherited their wealth, nearly 14% of the millionaires in our sample? The typical wealth inheritor spent in excess of $36,000 for his most expensive motor vehicle. In sharp contrast, the typical self-made millionaire paid much less, approximately $27,000, or almost $9,000 less than millionaires who inherited their wealth. Thus, the typical American buyer of a new motor vehicle today spends about 78% of what the typical self-made millionaire does for his most expensive motor vehicle. You can look at all of this another way. The typical millionaire in our survey spent about $29,000 for his most expensive motor vehicle. This equates to less than 1% of his net worth. The average buyer of a motor vehicle in America has a net worth that is less than 2% of that of those millionaires. Do they buy motor vehicles that cost 2% of what millionaires pay? If they did, they would spend on average about $580, or 2% of $29,000. Instead, typical motor vehicle buyers spend the equivalent of at least 30% of their net worth for such purchases. On average, American consumers buy new motor vehicles at a price that is 72% of the most that a typical millionaire ever spent on a motor vehicle. Does this give you some idea of why so few Americans are millionaires? Those millionaires who lease vehicles are a minority, fewer than 20%. What was the price of their most recent acquisition or lease? We estimate that 50% leased vehicles that were priced at $31,680 or less. About 80% leased vehicles valued at or under $44,500. People often ask us, should I lease? Our answer is always the same. More than 80% of millionaires purchase their vehicles. If and when more than 50% begin leasing, we will change our recommendation. Makes of motor vehicles. What types of motor vehicles do millionaires drive? U.S. car manufacturers may be pleased to note that their makes account for 57.7% of the vehicles millionaires are driving. Japanese makes account for 23.5%, while European manufacturers hold 18.8%. What makes of cars are most popular with millionaires? The following are listed in rank order according to their respective market shares. 1. Ford, 9.4%. The most popular models include the F-150 pickup and the Explorer sports utility vehicle. American sports utility vehicles in general are becoming increasingly popular with the affluent. About 3 in 10 millionaire Ford drivers own F-150 pickups. About 1 in 4 drive Ford Explorers. Note that the F-150 pickup is the number one vehicle sold in America. Thus, drivers of pickups have something in common with many millionaires. 2. Cadillac, 8.8%. More than 60% of Cadillac owners drive the DeVille Fleetwood Brougham. 3. Lincoln, 7.8%. About half have Lincoln Town Cars. 4. A three-way tie. Jeep, Lexus, Mercedes. 6.4% each. Almost all millionaires who own Jeeps choose the Grand Cherokee sports utility model. In fact, this model ranks first among all models owned by millionaires. Nearly two-thirds of Lexus drivers choose the LS400 model. The favorite model of Mercedes-Benz is the S-Class. 5. Oldsmobile, 5.9%. The overall favorite model is the Olds 98. 6. Chevrolet, 5.6%. 10 different models are represented. The most popular include the Suburban and the Blazer sports utility vehicles. 7. Toyota, 5.1%. The Camry model accounts for more than half of this segment. 8. Buick, 4.3%. The LeSabre and Park Avenue models were found to be most popular. 9. A two-way tie, Nissan and Volvo, 2.9% each. The most popular Nissan is the Pathfinder sports utility vehicle. For Volvo, it is the 200 series. 10. A two-way tie, Chrysler and Jaguar, 2.7% each. Other popular makes include Dodge, BMW, Mazda, Saab, Infiniti, Mercury, Acura, Honda, GMC, Volkswagen, Land Rover, Subaru, Pontiac, Audi, Isuzu, Plymouth, and Mitsubishi. The top three manufacturers are General Motors Corporation, with approximately 26.7% of the millionaire population, Ford Motor Company with 19.1%, and Chrysler with about 11.8%. As you can see, most millionaires are driving so-called Detroit metal. Most Americans who own motor vehicles also drive Detroit metal. How then can you tell if your neighbor who is driving a Ford, a Cadillac, or a Jeep is a millionaire or not? You can't. It's not easy to judge the wealth characteristics of people by the motor vehicles they drive. An increasing number of affluent people are purchasing vehicles produced by American manufacturers, especially Buicks, Cadillacs, Chevrolets, Chryslers, Fords, Lincolns, and Oldsmobiles. This trend is related to the growing popularity of sports utility vehicles produced by Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors. What is it about Detroit metal that appeals to the wealthy? We can answer that question by reflecting on something that took place more than 15 years ago. After interviewing a group of 10 millionaires, we walked into the parking lot of the research facility. We were very surprised to see that almost all of the millionaires we had just interviewed were driving full-sized Detroit metal, including Buicks, Fords, and Oldsmobiles. We looked at each other. One said, "These people are not into status. They buy automobiles by the pound." It's true. Many American millionaires have a propensity to purchase full-sized automobiles that have a low cost per pound. The average per pound price for all new motor vehicles is $6.86. The full-sized Buick four-door sedan currently sells for less than $6 a pound. The Chevrolet Caprice about $5.27 per pound. The Ford Crown Victoria about $5.50. The Lincoln Town Car less than $10 a pound. And the Cadillac Fleetwood, $8.26 a pound. The Ford Explorer sells for about $5.98 a pound. The most popular model among millionaires is the Jeep Grand Cherokee, which sells for $7.09 a pound. How do these costs per pound compare with those of full